I'm Callie Crossley. This is Boston Public Radio. You know, we're deep into summer when we're talking about shark tournaments on Cape Cod. It's Friday, which means it's our time for our Week in Review, local news that went under the radar. Today, we're going regional, looking at a suburban sprawl in Rhode Island, nepotism in New Hampshire, and, of course, sharks galore on the Cape. Here with me to talk about these stories and more are radio and TV commentator Arnie Arneson, Paul Pronovo of the Cape Cod Times, and Robert Whitcomb with the Providence Journal. Welcome back, everybody.
Hi, folks.
Thanks, Kelly.
Well, got to start down on the Cape, but not with the sharks just yet. I want to look at D.A. Michael O'Keefe calling the anti-crime bill, also known as the Melissa's bill, also known as the habitual offender bill and three strikes legislation. He's calling it a fraud. Why is that?
Yeah, this is interesting because, you know, anytime you have what is known sort of as an anti-crime bill, and especially one that has sort of a name recognition associated with it, in this case, Melissa Gazul, it's so named Melissa's bill, you would think the prosecutors would be all for it. But in the case of Mike O'Keefe, the district attorney here on the Cape and the Islands, and in fact some other DAs across the Bay State, they've come out against it. And Mike O'Keefe is using some pretty strong language, calling it a fraud on the public, says that it does more to protect the victims than punish the criminals, and in fact goes so far as to say that Melissa's bill, if it were to become Melissa's law, would not even have protected Melissa Gazul. She was a 27-year-old school teacher who her automobile broke down on the side of the Cape Cod Canal. A supposed Good Samaritan stopped to help her. That Good Samaritan turned out to be Michael Gentile, a convicted criminal 27 times. Melissa was not seen again for about 8 days when she was found. It was in a wooded area. She had been raped and killed. And so this bill intends to head things like that off. Basically, there is what's known as a three strikes provision associated with it. So people like Michael Gentile perhaps would not have been in a position to commit a crime like that because of his past record. The district attorney says that because of the nuances of the crimes Gentile perpetrated, he would still have been out on the streets and possibly could have committed this crime. So Melissa would not have even been protected by Melissa's bill. So that's the backdrop. On the other side of it is a whole political angle associated with this. The House and the Senate in Massachusetts had different versions of this bill. The Senate's was far more of a crime bill, whereas the House's was more specific to the Melissa's bill and the three strikes rule. When they came out of conference committee, a lot of the Senate's provisions were knocked out, and these were things that Mike O'Keefe really wanted to see. Wiretap provisions improved, some other criminal penalties, including post-release supervision provisions installed. And because those were stripped out, he felt that this bill should be tabled and they should come back next year.
So, Paul Pronovo, editor of the Cape Cod Times, your piece on Thursday said that the bill could get to the Senate very quickly. And by the way, the House voted 139-14. Michael O'Keefe, as you've just indicated, urged the governor to veto the bill, but it's, I guess, got to go back to the Senate. What's happening?
In fact, it has last evening passed the Senate. It goes to the governor's desk for either signature or veto. And I think this is why Mike O'Keefe and others are coming out and sort of making a public statement. They're hoping that the governor will reject it. The governor all along has said that he would support a quote-unquote balanced bill. And so, you know, the political dance that they're using in O'Keefe's statement, he said that he hopes that the governor rejects this unbalanced bill and, you know, give sort of political cover for the governor to say, you're right, unbalanced, veto, bring it back next year and let's take a look at it. On the flip side...
Bob here. Wouldn't current law cover all this stuff, this kind of crime?
It covers the individual...
It sort of sounds redundant. It sounds like these horrific crimes should all be covered by current statute.
Right, and no is the short answer. What this bill intends to do is address, a series of loopholes, and we've all seen these over time with these loopholes where criminals have been repeat offenders over repeat offenders, and yet they somehow still get out on the street. So this is something that, in fact, Melissa's dad had been pushing for more than 10 years to close the loopholes. He still supports the bill, even though, as Michael O'Keefe points out, it might not have even protected his daughter.
So the loopholes are entirely really about the repeated
Yes.
Status.
Habitual offender is the phrase to.
So it's totally focused on that.
Yeah.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. And I want to remind everyone that, you know, perfection never happens with a legislature. So you never get everything you want. And here's the beauty of legislation. You change it next year. And so it's going to be really interesting to see whether the politics of this, and that it's such a good headline for a lot of politicians that they'll sign it into law. And then what happens is the prosecutors are going to have to sit down and say, look what you left out. Look what you did. Yeah. Now it's void for vagueness. And then someone can come back in and say, you know what? This didn't go far enough. There wasn't enough clarity. This is legislation. This isn't the damn Constitution. So the question is, let's look at the cost-benefit analysis here. Do you gain something of value? Do you not get what the prosecutors want? But that does not preclude you from not going in next year and looking at electronic surveillance, looking at some of those issues there. I just want people to remember that, you know, this is why you hate watching legislation. It's like making sausage. But the question is, do you get more value than you lose?
And are there unintended consequences of this sort of bill?
Well, I think it's a dicey time that all of you would agree, and Paul Pronovost, you've seen this play out now with the latest turn with District Attorney Michael O'Keefe and others, and that is when you say crime and you say repeat offenders, all kinds of buttons are pushed by various peoples who might not even be engaged with the law, but who want something to happen. So that probably pushes forth legislation that may be not quite perfect or clear in ways that other legislation might be delayed.
Against people think talking about the death penalty, too.
Yeah.
And when you have someone who symbolizes the bill you're trying to push, in this case, it's Melissa, you know, there's sort of an emotional aspect to it. And I think what Michael O'Keefe is trying to say is, hey, everybody, let's look behind the curtain of what's emerged from conference committee and see what this law actually entails and see if this is what we intended to pass. And his point is that he doesn't think it is.
Mm-hmm. And let me just celebrate something he said, because I think it's really important because he made this point. He says, quote, there is an old saying that hard cases make bad law.
Yeah.
I suggest that legislation by tragedy is bad public policy. And just those two sentences alone, I am sympathetic to O'Keefe on this
and
one.
And controversial
because he's absolutely
cases
right.
make bad law.
That's right.
And frankly, that's what could give the governor cover, which is maybe we need a little more distance here to make sure the law we put into place actually does protect the victims we're so worried about.
So. All right. Well, let's move on. And Robert Whitcomb, I tell you, every time you send a story our way, I'm going, what?
So here, more meds.
This is one of those stories. So Rhode Island School of Design is getting semi-exclusive access to some streets in Providence.
You bet. It's sort of like Brown. Brown, a few weeks ago, coughed up some more money to the financially strapped city and took over a whole bunch of streets and the fanciest part of town. And now RISD, as we call it down here, has done something a little bit similar. They're getting sort of, I think it's 24-hour priority for parking on streets around the school, which is, you know, in a very pretty part of town, the bottom of something called College Hill along the river. And it just shows to me, I sort of laughed out loud when I saw it, as I did when I saw the map of all the city streets being taken over by Brown. Brown and RISD and institutions like that are looking ahead 10 or 20 years. The mayor and the city council looking ahead to the next election. They don't want to raise property taxes. They raised property taxes last year. The city, as many old cities, has been in deep financial trouble for a variety of reasons, pension plans and the recession. So anyway, everybody, after Brown did this deal, everybody's waiting for the other shoe to drop, which was RISD, which is right cheek by jowl with Brown. And they basically have gotten control of a bunch of streets for parking 24/7. So I think they came out ahead. This addresses some of the city's short-term fiscal issues, but in the long term, it's not necessarily a good thing for the city.
So let me put the
losing that revenue,
right?
That parking revenue.
I want to tell people what how much money is at stake here. So RISD agreed to pay an additional $250,000 a year for the next 11 years.
You bet.
So now that brings its annual payments, they don't pay taxes, to more than $425,000 a year. And totally, as your story pointed out, the city has secured $44 million in additional contributions contributions from six of the city's largest tax-exempt institutions.
Now, hospitals and so on.
From a practical standpoint, does that mean that you and I cannot park on these streets? What does this mean?
I think it really does, Kelly, effectively. Because, you know, it's fairy. They've got all the students, the faculty, the staff. I think they're going to... Yeah, they could be parking in the streets. It's going to be very difficult to park there. And by the way, there's a big courthouse there, rather spectacular thing with the Supreme and Superior Court. So people going to court are going to find it tougher to park. And it's a pretty densely populated area. What's left of the old downtown financial section, you know, the banking section, has got lots of people in it still. So you have this right in the middle of this densely populated kind of churning area. You're going to have all these streets taken over by private institutions that are not paying tax, not paying property tax. They're paying, payment in lieu of taxes.
And this is where I'm torn on this one, Robert, because I'm of two minds. One is I want to support these nonprofit institutions, you know, Brown,
Johnson & Wells.
They're great.
We love
having
them here.
Right.
The place going. Yeah.
Right. So, but at the same time, since communities like Providence, like most communities, are so property tax dependent, because they've seen less and less money coming back from the state, less and less money coming back from the feds, that means they become more dependent on those that have to pay at a specific rate. So when you're making a payment in lieu of taxes, you kind of are elastic. You can send them more. You can say, I don't have to give you that much anyway. But part of the problem, I think, for both RISD and for Brown and those other institutions is you cut off your nose to spite your face. Because if you don't send them enough money, the community caves. If you send them enough money, you're almost, though, doing what I consider a piece of blackmail.
Yeah,
you see,
that's
what this is. It's blackmail. I'll give you an extra $250,000, but I want these two streets. I'll give you an
public
half
loses
million.
The space.
Exactly.
Public space is this sort of
exactly.
It's this endless erosion into public space
by private money.
Yep.
Exactly,
I think that I find that troubling. I can understand why the city does it. The current regime here is pretty honest. They're trying hard. The mayor is smart. His chief administration is smart. But they're, you know, still they're just trying to get through the next few months until the next election.
And we should point out, Robert, that Providence is cash strapped. I mean, this is very serious business here. So
that is an understatement.
You know,
pass the hat.
All right.
Well, Bob, what has been the reaction from, you know, the folks in the city? I mean, obviously
People in the city are sort of, I think many of them are flabbergasted. I mean, the Brown thing was even more impressive, especially after the paper printed a map of it, the sort of core area near the Brown campus, now pretty much completely taken over by the university, most of whose students, by the way, come from away, as they say, and are very affluent. I think the average family income for Brown students is $170,000 a year. So you've got, it's sort of like Scarsdale in Providence. So you saw that. Now you've got these streets at the bottom of the hill. If those of you who've been to Providence know what I mean, they're all also, to not completely, but to a large extent, being taken over by, again, a private institution, most of whom students, by the way, come from some other place. And I think there's some resentment. At the same time, the anti-tax obsession is so great, I suppose that trumps the giving away of public space, at least for a while. Because,
but
there's such
a
theology against any tax raise.
Yeah, well,
you know, but it bothers me because these are supposedly academic liberal institutions. They know what they're doing. I mean, this is the problem. You are eating the future of the city. This is where the city gets to grow. This is where its future revenue comes. So by taking that over, you're denying the city something they're going to need 5 years, 10 years down the road, because you're throwing them some dimes today. That's
right.
Part of the problem. We're all in this mess together. Providence is part of their community. Why do you need something to cough up $250,000 more? You probably have it in your coffers. The city could benefit from it, and we have to get off this anti-tax thing, too, because that doesn't help anyone. But these are the only way these nonprofits can actually give more, is they have to write a bigger check because they are tax-exempt institutions. Mm. So the only vehicle for them is to say, I'll give you a half million more. I'll give you $250,000.
Also, Arnie, I think another issue is the whole property tax system, which screws up public education and everything else. I think we have to, everywhere, I'm talking about Boston and every I think we really need a, you know, a agonizing reappraisal, so to speak, of the property taxes.
Well, that may come at some point, but right now we're going to move to another story. I am talking with great folks from the greater New England area in our local regional weekend review. I'm speaking with Paul Pronovo, editor of the Cape Cod Times, Robert Whitcomb, vice president and editorial page editor of the Providence Journal, and radio and TV commentator Arnie Arneson. So, Arnie, we turn to you now with a whole nepotism thing going on in New Hampshire. I just kept trying to figure out, is everybody a relative working for somebody in New Hampshire?
No.
Who do we send our CVs to?
Yeah, that's right. Well, first of all, what happened was that the Department of Employment Security, which does unemployment compensation, just let me remind you, what happened was Tara Reardon was the commissioner. She had her daughter hired. And instead of having her daughter let go at the end of the summer for her, whatever the time frame she was, she wanted her to be let go in such a manner that she could then collect unemployment. Okay.
Oh.
So she knows how the system works. Mm. She knew how to rig the system, and she wanted it rigged for her daughter. Well, it turns out that other people in employment security also have their children working, and it turns out they also know how to use the unemployment system. And so they managed to do this. Well, this became a huge, huge problem for the commissioner to the point where she had to step down. Now, there's a sidebar here I want you to know. There is a lot of unhappiness within the Department of Employment Security with the commissioner. So this is partial vendetta as well as, explodes the nepotism. So there's two stories going on. Well, of course, what happens is my Speaker of the House, who thinks he is a god, has now decided that this must be a problem.
Send the email to Arnie. Continue.
That's right. Despot O'Brien has now decided that he is going to send a letter to every department and say, I want to know about the relatives working in your department. Well, the problem with the Speaker of the House sending a letter to the executive branch and demanding all this information is, honey, that's not your job. This is the executive branch, not the legislative branch. And if you read our Constitution, something he refers to but never obviously reads, he would notice that in Article 37, there's a section called separation of powers. And the separation of powers says, you have your job. If you have a problem, contact the governor and make the suggestion to the governor that maybe we should do an investigation to find out if there are problems in other departments. Now, last but not least, I just want to also let you know that there is a law in New Hampshire that says nepotism is not allowed. And it turns out that it was the Democrats in 2007 or 2008 that actually looked at this problem with nepotism under a lot of Republican rule, which is almost exclusive in New Hampshire, and they were the ones that passed legislation that actually said that nepotism should, in fact, not be part of the game in New Hampshire. So there's a lot of both Republican, Democrat, backstory, separation of powers. You gotta love it.
Well, how much is nepotism a big problem in sort of straight back rectitude New Hampshire?
Well, you know, everyone's
sounds
related.
Well,
we're a small
Rhode Island
state.
Comes to mind.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. We're a small state. You know, what can I tell you? Everybody knows everybody's aunt and uncle. The problem here, though, is that it was employment security, and she knew how to sort of work the system so her daughter could collect unemployment. That's right. When you're really pushing the envelope here, sweetheart.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so, I want to say I'm shocked to find that there's gambling in this establishment.
Yeah.
But,
exactly.
Of course there's nepotism, but the question here is, how did this commissioner, if she had people who were out to get her, think she was going to get away with something that seems as blatant
you.
As it was?
I love you. I love you. I love you. How day are you? You know that your staff is so angry at you. They're looking for something. They're looking for a smoking gun, and you had an atomic weapon. It's just
by
ridiculous.
By the way, why is the staff so angry? Is this person obnoxious?
I don't know.
Offensive?
I think she's made certain changes that people found wrong, and she doesn't have the kind of relationships other commissioners have had. But you know what? If you know that people are unhappy with you, don't give them something that is legitimate. And that's exactly what she handed them. And that shows foolishness. And frankly, given the fact that you are the head of employment security, you need to be even more sensitized to the nature of employment.
All right. So just for a button on this, the law says relatives are allowed to work together, but department heads and supervisors cannot be involved in hiring relatives or in making supervisory decisions that affect them.
I think a commissioner is the head. I just think that's her job title. And I think her daughter is a relative. So, okay. I mean, I think it's pretty obvious.
All right. They all need jobs in the Massachusetts Probation Department.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, right.
That
okay.
I'm dumb.
Remember that?
Yes, we do.
Yes,
Robert Wickham, thank you. Stay in your own state.
No invasions.
Back to you, Paul Pronovost, down on the Cape, because we had that fantastic, interesting story about the poor kayaker, first time in a boat, and a shark following him, and thought it was a great white. Turns out it was a veggie shark. But still, now, hadn't heard this, but there's been another close encounter of the shark kind for a Cape lifeguard, and this one was a real, looks like a, you know, not the veggie kind.
Well, Greg Scommel, the Massachusetts shark expert, says, well, maybe that too was a basking shark, but the folks who were observing this said, I don't know, that felt like a pretty aggressive shark behavior. And what happened here was last week, a Cape lifeguard was basically going through his standard morning exercise. He basically paddleboards 100 yards out to a big plastic buoy, picks it up, drops it down as sort of just sort of a point of emphasis, and then kind of paddles back. Well, as he was paddling back this time, he didn't know what was going on, but he saw that people on the beach were starting to whistle and frantically wave at him, and he realized there was splashing and thrashing behind him, and 25 feet behind the lifeguard, a fin poked out of the waves, and the buoy was getting thrashed about. So exactly the sort of scene that you worry about. The lifeguard paddled in quickly in a state of shock, but perfectly safe. I mean, this is where we're talking about close encounters now, it seems like, on a weekly basis with sharks. Was it a great white? There's no definitive evidence. Unlike the kayaker and what appears to be a basking shark, there was no photographic evidence to take a look at, but it was either it was a shark that got tangled up in a buoy, or it was a shark that the splashing of the buoy resembled the motions of a seal, and they went after it. Much like the kayaker, it almost doesn't matter when you see that dorsal fin behind you. You're still going to react in a certain way, and that's what happened here.
Well, are there more sharks this year? Warmer water? Global warming and all that stuff.
Yeah, they think it's not necessarily that there are more sharks in the water, but the proximity of the seals are closer to the people, and therefore the proximity of the sharks are closer to the people.
Yeah.
They've spotted, I think last week, about 11 great white sharks in that stretch of beach from Chatham to Nauset Beach in Orleans, and they're pretty close into shore. And, it's great from a researcher's standpoint. They're tagging them on almost a daily basis, which is bringing all sorts of science back here that they didn't have before on great whites. But as you might imagine, it's a little unsettling for the beachgoers and the lifeguards in particular, who, you know, regardless of the situation, if there's an emergency, they got to get out on the water.
So, Paul Pronovost, you folks at the Cape Cod Times have become like shark central down there. And so I think it's interesting, because you and I had spoken about how a lot of people are actually rushing to the Cape to try to catch a glimpse of these sharks. It's become a big tourist thing, but now you have the annual Vineyard Shark Contest coming up, and it doesn't seem to be attracting as many folks as it used to in the past when there were fewer shark sightings. So what's up with that?
Yeah, well, this is interesting because, on the beaches of Cape Cod, this notion of sharks is fascinating, and people, as we discussed, are coming down in sort of a tourism looky-loo way, and that's interesting. On Martha's Vineyard, for 26 years, they've run a shark catching tournament. And in the past years, it's aired on ESPN and Spike TV, and 265 boats from as far away as Alaska have converged on the island to participate in this weekend-long tournament where they go out and catch and bring back and weigh for sport sharks of several different species. This year, they're expecting about 100 boats. Largely, they believe it's the economy. I mean, this is a rich man's game to be out there doing that, to play. There was some controversy a couple years ago. A lot of animal rights organizations protested the tournament, and that might have turned some folks off. But what's interesting is it's almost turning, because a lot of biologists and certainly shark experts, they, at the same time as the tournament, they too come to Martha's Vineyard because it gives them a chance to get up close and personal with these sharks. That once they're weighed, they can do their science on them, and you've got people from around the world who come to participate in that.
I hope not too many are endangered species. No, and it, countdown yeah, and, of that.
And that's one of the rules, of course, is that you can only catch certain species of sharks. Anything yeah. that's endangered, they can't bring in. I mean, you almost can't help what you catch, but you got to release it. Great whites, for example, are outlawed. But tiger sharks are popular, and tiger sharks are plentiful in local waters. And they come in, and when you see them, it's a big hoopla, and it'll happen, frankly, this afternoon at about 5 o'clock. All these boats will steam into Oak Bluffs Harbor. They'll pull the sharks out. They'll weigh them. They'll hold up their mouth so you can see the big toothy grins that they have. And when you see that, it doesn't matter if it's a tiger or a great white. It's a big fish.
I'm telling you.
An affectionate grimace.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed.
All right, back to you, Robert Whitcomb, where money is the central issue. But this is a good story. It's very interesting about this company, Alex and Ani, which is located in Cranston, Rhode Island, and what's happening there with new business and taking over an old business.
Yeah, they're opening up, Kelly, they're opening up some coffee and tea shops. And they're going to be selling wine, too. And as part of this, they're buying the Saconnet Vineyards in Little Compton, Rhode Island. And the Saconnet Vineyard is one of the oldest vineyards in New England. It's been sort of, I think, misstated as the oldest, but certainly one of the oldest. And one of the things that struck me about that was that these vineyards have some currency. I mean, you know, some of them make money. There's a whole region of them in southeastern Massachusetts and parts of eastern Connecticut and in the extreme sort of southeastern part of Rhode Island, because the climate's actually rather similar to that in Bordeaux, say, or in southwest France and some other famous winemaking regions. So they're buying the Saconnet Vineyards, presumably they're going to be selling some of that wine, which ain't bad, even the reds. Usually the complaint has been that the U.S. Northeast, that we can't make red wine, so they make some good ones. The other thing I think that's pleasant about that is the Connaught Vineyard won't be broken up. It'll be maintained right. as agricultural land. And I think that's great. It reduces sprawl in this very lovely area that's quite close to urban centers of New Bedford and Fall River. And it kind of keeps the land open and produces
what's their business plan? Because I'm looking at all these things. They're a fast-growing jewelry company. They're opening up coffee bars. They're buying the vineyards. They have a business school. And I'm thinking, like, what is their vision? Is it that they want to sort of maintain the landscape? And this is kind of the way they do it, because they want to say, we want to attract this kind of clientele, so we're going to have teas and javas.
Yeah, I think it's sort of a psychiatric thing. They want to be associated with kind of the, you know, good living, okay?
Exactly.
And this
exactly.
is a nice, you know, and it's, let's face it, it's more for affluent people. They're pitching this thing, if not to the rich, certainly to the upper middle class. And this vineyard in Little Compton, which is a very rich town, as you all probably know, it's sort of, you know, it kind of wraps on an aura of style and privilege to some extent. But around here, we'll take any jobs we can get. And and you know, will again protect whatever it is, about 170 acres of land in Little Compton, where I do not live, by the way. I live in the gritty city of Providence, so I'm not a direct beneficiary.
Well, a couple of things that let me point out. First of all, Saconnet is a known vineyard in this area. A lot of people don't know that there are wine vineyards in every state in the union.
Absolutely.
So that's the first thing. So this is really you know, the fact that they're keeping this vineyard together and keeping it going is really important to the economy there in many ways, because that wine is known outside of its, you know, little narrow area.
Absolutely.
I've had that wine. It's quite
good. Important. Yeah. It's a real wine region. There are other pretty well-known vineyards in the same area, too.
And then let me just say one other thing. The company Alex and Ani has done an explosive business, is doing, I should not say it's over, with these bracelets that everybody's wearing, including one of my colleagues.
Oh, really?
They're very, very popular now. Yeah. I was looking at them thinking, hey, I think I want that. So
you
I think
can
it's,
look at them when they're lifting their glass.
That's right. So I think it's clever to take a you know, locally based company, as they are, in one area, and then open up tea, javas, and really highlight a long-established company like Saconnet. I think that's and their product. That to me is brilliant, actually.
Happy news.
Well, yeah. You know, it's interesting. This morning I was doing a radio show and I was interviewing some organic farmers. And one of the things I said to people is not only do you want to support the organic farmer, understand what the organic farmer does. They maintain the integrity of the landscape. That's what they do. And that's what this vineyard also does. And if they care about Compton and they know this has been around a lot and this is probably very valuable land, one of the ways to maintain the integrity of the landscape is to buy it and to maintain it as a vineyard. It's both good for the economy, but it's also good for what you look at.
It
so it's a win-win strategy.
That's right.
Keeps
exactly.
The money local.
And the product is good. We need to say that. They're not, you know, doing schlock wine. This is known.
That's good to know.
You know,
usually have two or three bottles a day.
There you go.
Yeah. Bob, can you imagine the price of the houses in Little Compton if they turned the vineyard into subdivisions?
Yeah, I know.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
Well, that's good news for Providence, Rhode Island.
Yeah.
All right, I got to go back to you, Paul Pronovo, because you and I had talked about the casino pack that seemed, you know, good to go with the Mashpee-Wampanoag trial, and now there are some area legislators that are not too happy with the deal that was cut with Governor Deval Patrick.
Right. The New Bedford area lawmakers appear to be the turtles in the highway of the race for this casino proposal to move through. They've sort of thrust themselves in the middle of this. They've never been happy with the notion that the Mashpee-Wampanoag, or really any Indian tribe, but in reality it becomes the Mashpee-Wampanoag, have had sort of an inside track to the southeastern Massachusetts casino when Massachusetts legalized casino gaming and said that there'd be three casinos geographically spread out, one in southeastern Mass. With the tribe getting preferential treatment, that essentially froze out New Bedford from pursuing a casino interest, or effectively froze out because, in fact, they're still pursuing one. In fact, they have a developer who's very interested in building in New Bedford, and New Bedford is a very depressed city. They've been looking for some economic drivers for some time. They firmly believe that casinos would be one of them. In fact, they courted, sort of in the, if you can't beat them, join them, courted the tribe for a while, and then the tribe ultimately settled in Taunton. So fast forward to the legislative debate of the governor's compact, and in the House, virtually every southeastern Massachusetts lawmaker stood up in opposition of this measure, and of course it was overwhelmingly passed in a roll call vote. It was basically the New Bedford folks who stood up against it. Meanwhile, it moves to the Senate. And Senator Mark Montigny of New Bedford said, you know what, not only am I going to vote no, but I'm going to see if I can pull some legislative maneuvers to slow this down. And that's exactly what he did. Hmm. He essentially invoked the lay on the table proposition, which basically stops the measure, doesn't allow it to be voted on. This, of course, drew the ire of Senate President Terry Murray and others who said, you know what, we're gonna draw a line. And as of Tuesday, lay on the table measures are not eligible till the end of the session, which is July 31st. Effectively, what she was doing was she said, you only get till Tuesday to stop this, and then on Wednesday we're coming back and we're going to vote this in. Because really, the legislature has said, as soon as the governor handed it to them, we're not going to add any amendments. We're not going to bog this down. Essentially, we're not going to stop this. We're going to move it through. So New Bedford tried, and it looks like they slowed it, but ultimately will fail.
It's a done deal, Paul, then, the Taunton thing?
Well, it's a done deal.
Really.
Yeah, as far as the legislature is concerned, it appears to be. But in terms of, and this is the argument that several of the New Bedford lawmakers made, was the tribe still has to take land into federal trust. Yeah. And until they do that, they can't basically build on Taunton. Taunton's not their land until the feds agree that it is. And so what New Bedford is arguing, unfortunately, they're not winning this argument, but they're saying, look, maybe that land into trust won't happen for years. So while we have a proposal sitting here, you're going to be holding us up where we could get something done because the Mashpee Wampanoags don't have an agreement. So it's not a done deal in the long way, but it certainly looks like a done deal as far as Massachusetts.
There's some legitimacy there, though. Am I right, Paul? There's some legitimacy there because this is a time sensitive situation. They want to build those casinos fairly quickly. If they don't have an agreement and it does take a long time, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, then they've lost that opportunity when another casino could have been built. Why didn't they put a time specific on it? No, I mean a reasonable time, saying if they can't do this within 4 years, then maybe we can renegotiate. Because I think it's kind of unfair to hold it up for an indefinite period of time. At least this way, there is some legitimacy. At least New Bedford will think, well, maybe there's a candle in the wind somewhere and maybe I can get it. But I think it at least recognizes why you wanted three casinos, not two and one mañana.
Right.
Well, the only thing I would say about that, and then all of that is very reasonable, Arnie, is that there was a July 1st, there is a July 31st deadline for all of this, and the tribe has met it. So, you know, you can yammer all you want about let's have New Bedford do this, but, you know, where's your plan? July 31st, it's here. You know, now maybe something would happen until, you know, in these last few days before the end of the month, and so that's a possibility. Anything's a possibility. But in fact, what the tribe did was, you know, outmaneuver them at this point. And so we'll see what happens in the end. It's all about jobs for everybody on the table here. That's why there is much interest and angst about it.
And everyone wants the jobs in their neighborhood.
Exactly.
Which is why this fight is on.
Right.
Even though
right.
it could end up reducing jobs in the region.
Well,
out of New England.
It could. We'll see. All right. Last story. Arnie, Vermont is canceling the Massachusetts jail contract.
Well, first of all, let's start with something. Right now, Vermont is actually sending some of their prisoners out to three different places. One, to a public prison in Massachusetts, and then I believe to a private prison in Kentucky and somewhere else. And part of the rationale for sending them out of state is that it's costing them $47,000 on average to keep an inmate in Vermont. That's exactly what some of the comments was. They said that. Cut the difference. Give them $23,000. You pay $23,000 and send them to Harvard. But what happened was, it was apparently a group of Vermonters were in a prison in Massachusetts. They actually had the conditions were horrific. And because the conditions were so bad, they organized, they broke glass, they cost, I think, $500,000 in damage to this Massachusetts prison to get the attention of folks in Vermont. They decided, after looking at the conditions at this Massachusetts prison, that they would cancel the contract and bring them home. And that's ultimately what they've done. And what you need to know is a lot of Vermonters are concerned not just about the prisoners in Massachusetts, but the prisoners in private prisons in other states, saying, you know what, these are our criminals. They're our residents. Right. If there's something wrong, they should be closer to their family. They should be in the state of Vermont. So in some ways, you know, canceling the contract with Massachusetts is the beginning of, I think, Vermont beginning to say, we need to bring them home. Hmm. So it's an interesting story, especially at a time where, for example, in my state, we're looking at the whole idea of privatizing prisons.
Not just for
New Hampshire. Exactly. And here's Vermont saying, you know what, maybe we made a mistake. Let's bring them back.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're all communists in Vermont. What do you expect?
Well, that's, you know, yeah.
Send the emails to Robert Whitcomb. I want to thank you all for your insightful comments and giving us our local under-the-radar regional stories this week. We've been going over the local and regional news, focusing on greater New England. I've been speaking with Paul Pronovost, editor of the Cape Cod Times, Robert Whitcomb, vice president and editorial page editor of the Providence Journal, and radio and TV commentator Arnie Arneson. Thanks, all.
Ciao.
Thanks, Kelly. Have a good weekend, everyone.
Happy weekend.
Bye-bye. I see our resident music geek, Edgar B. Herwick III, entering the studio. What do you got in store for us today, Edgar?
Well, Callie, it is Friday, so we are talking music, and I want you to just have a listen to this right here. Can we bring that music up a little?
I like the singer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's great. So let me ask you this. Would you call this folk music?
I actually wouldn't.
Well, it's folk music to the man behind the Newport Folk Festival. We're going to talk with him in a second about this year's festival, and I think you're going to be surprised by some of the acts that are going to be taking the stage down at Fort Adams.
All right. That is Edgar Herwick. I am Callie Crossley, and this is Boston Public Radio.